If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, August the 27th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. My guest today here in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office, which is just east of the White House, is Michael Anton. He's a lecturer in politics and a research fellow at Hillsdale College's Alan P. Kirby Jr. Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship. Prior to that, he was a deputy assistant to the president for strategic communications at the National Security Council. In fact, Mike Anton's twice worked at the NSC, for the Trump White House and from 2001 to 2005, the Bush 43 White House, where he was the NSC's director for communications, and special assistant to the president, and senior director for foreign policy speech writing. I first met Michael Anton 20 years ago in Sacramento when we both were writing speeches for the governor of California. Mike, you've had quite a journey the past 20 years, haven't you?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, so
let's
put the little car on the map and let's take you out of Sacramento. And your first stop after Sacramento is New York City and Rudy Giuliani.
Right. Rudy's second term, pre-9/11. I wasn't actually there. I had already gone to Washington by 9/11. But I was there for what was supposed to be the most epic, you know, non-presidential election campaign in American political history, the Rudy versus Hillary, you know, the mayor versus a sitting first lady.
Right.
And it obviously did not come to pass because the mayor withdrew from the race in the spring of 2000, but it was a much anticipated fight.
That had it all. It had money, it had personality,
yeah.
Next president of the White House coming out of this race.
And, yeah.
But it didn't work. He backed out of it. Rightly so. He probably would have lost if he'd stayed in, right?
I mean, New York was certainly Rick Lazio, who replaced him, lost by 10 points. Rudy
right.
probably would not have lost by 10 points. But New York was fundamentally becoming a blue state. Mm-hmm. And really, it already was. I mean, in 1998, when you and I were still in Sacramento, Chuck Schumer beat Al D'Amato, a three-term incumbent and Republican senator. And New York has not had a Republican senator since.
Right. You then detour from New York City to the south to Washington, D.C., and you end up at the White House by way of, oddly enough, the Agricultural Department.
Well, I started in the Ag Department. That was also the California connection. The Secretary of Agriculture at the time was Ann Veneman, who had been Pete Wilson's, the equivalent of the Ag Department in California.
Right.
And she was from California herself, from Modesto, actually went to the same high school as my father and as George Lucas, for people counting, Downey High. And American Graffiti, I recommend. This is sort of a movie about the last day of the summer for a bunch of Downey High kids. Then I wasn't there very long. I went to the CIA, also part of the California connection. Our friend Sean Walsh made that introduction, where I got one of the most prized things one can have in Washington, which is a high-level security clearance. And the reason they are prized is because they're expensive, they take a long time to do, the government has finite resources. But once you have one, it unlocks a lot of doors and you can do a lot of things and go a lot of places that you otherwise wouldn't go, which is one of the reasons that, you know, I was recruited to go over to the NSC, not because they recognized in me any great brilliance, but you have to have a TSSCI or a top-level clearance to work in the NSC, no exceptions, and I had one. So it's kind of the only reason, not the only reason. They also wanted me there because I had a political background. I was obviously a Republican.
Right.
And because I had speechwriting experience and they needed that. So I sort of fit the bill. But I think fundamentally the real reason was just I had a clearance.
You joined pre or post 9/11?
Just after.
And how long did it take for you to get clearance?
I had to get the clearance before I even walked into the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take very long, and I had, you know, friends of the family who've been in the Navy or around the national security bureaucracy just talk about how amazed they were that it was that quick.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was because, I mean, I was what, 30 at the time, 31, and, you know, it hadn't really – look, they're concerned about a couple of things. That foreign travel is big. Right, you got to remember every trip that you've ever taken, which I had a few, but not, I wasn't like in a foreign capital every other week, and all the foreign officials that you've ever talked to. Well, that was easy. It was basically zero, or maybe I met one member of parliament on a Claremont Institute trip or something like that. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I was all that complicated to investigate and clear. I wasn't even all that complicated to investigate and clear when I had to go back for the Trump administration.
Second time around, how long did it take?
The second time around, so I was granted an interim,
mm-hmm.
and there's a sort of window during which they know that there's going to be a massive turnover of people and a whole bunch of people will come in. So they still do the background investigation. You still have to fill out what's called your SF-86, which is this giant form that every place you've ever lived, every trip you've ever gone on, although the questions sort of break down into three time periods. Some things they ask you back to age 18. Mm-hmm. Some things they say last 10 years, and some things they say last 7 years. You right. fill out the form, you submit it. Whoever is doing your clearance, in my case, the FBI, they review it. They send some agents to interview you. They interview people you tell them to interview. And then they interview people that you don't necessarily tell them to interview. Mm-hmm. And you don't know. You just find out later. Somebody will say, hey, the FBI called, and they wanted to come and talk to me about you. And so mine was granted. I go into the administration. And then maybe 2 or 3 months later, I learned it was fully adjudicated, meaning they had closed the file, that they had answered every conceivable question. So you can be there on an interim. They allow interims. In the turnover of a new administration. Otherwise, the president would appoint a bunch of people and none of them could start working for him until April or May. So this is their way of speeding that process up.
What are your thoughts on the current controversy involving taking away clearances?
I mean, my thoughts are it's both deserved and overblown. I have never seen a former director of the CIA or any major intelligence agency behave the way Brennan and Clapper are behaving. And I would like to believe, in fact, I can confidently believe, although there's no direct evidence of this, that people inside, the real professionals, the real career nonpartisan professionals inside the intelligence community are not happy about it because they know it reflects badly on them and on their agencies and it breeds distrust with the very political people in the administration that they have to work with. But they're in sort of a difficult position because if you are a career intelligence professional, you can't really raise your hand up and say, those guys shouldn't be saying that. You're not supposed to talk about this kind of stuff at all. Right. So you might be appalled by it and think that it's damaging to your agency, and then you have to sit silently. The other point, though, is, look, the reason why people hold clearances after they're out of government, senior officials, is not because they're still getting information, although I believe presidents can receive intelligence briefings if they want them, former presidents.
Right.
But it's not like if you're a former director of the CIA, you have you have a classified setup. You have access to JWICS or some of the classified systems at home, and you can just look up classified information whenever you want. You can't. The only reason they keep your clearance active is in case the people in government at the time need to ask you questions about some kind of top secret program or issue, and they could not lawfully brief you or discuss those issues with you if you don't already have a clearance. And if they have to go through the formality of getting the clearance again, that means they might have to wait weeks or months. So keeping these things active is just, if we need to pull you back in to ask you questions, we can do that. And it's usually done for only a handful of officials, a former national security advisor, director of the CIA, director of the DNI, and so on. So, you know, I don't have any sympathy for Brennan. I mean, he's obviously just a partisan enemy of the president and behaving, as I said, in a way that no former CIA director ever has. But taking his clearance away, that's symbolic.
Right,
he deserves it, but it's not really going to do anything.
All right, we're taping this on August 27th, Mike, and a week from Wednesday, September the 5th, 2018, which is the 2-year anniversary of an article you wrote.
Yeah.
Claremont Review of Books, the Flight 93 election.
Yes.
Your byline for that was?
Publius. It's actually pronounced Decius, although I always pronounced it Decius.
Right.
Then again, I always ask the people who get pedantic about that, since there is no living Roman. We don't really know how Latin was pronounced, do we? So why are you being pedantic about that? So I had a blog shared with some other guys. We all took a Roman name, all but one of us. Mine was Decius, after a famous, there were more than one of them, but the most famous one is a consul of the Roman Republic discussed in Livy Book 8, who sacrifices himself at the Battle of Vesuvius. So the story goes that there's always two consuls. So after the Roman Republic is established and they expel the kings, they say, well, we're never going to have one guy in charge of anything again because that leads to tyranny. So every year we'll elect two consuls, and by dividing power, we reduce the chances for tyranny. Now, in the beginning, the consul really was the general. Like, if you were, we think of the political leader as the president. So these guys go out, they are the generals. They're leading the army in battle, and there's two of them. They take the auguries the night before, and the augur says, okay, one side in this fight is going to lose its general, and the other side is going to win the battle. Mm-hmm. But that side wins the battle. So one side will lose the general, the other side will lose the battle. And as they are fighting, Decius or Decius remembers this, and his side is losing. He dismounts from his horse to rally the troops and lead in battle, falls in the battle, but the Romans win the battle, and the Republic is saved. So I chose that name. I've been criticized for having chosen that name because people basically say, well, you didn't sacrifice anything. You're still here. You got a job in the Trump White House. I can go into all the reasons why I chose it, but maybe that's right. Maybe that's inappropriate right now.
Let's talk about why you chose the Flight 93 analogy. I'm going to read the first two paragraphs, Mike, and then I want you to update this. Here's what you wrote in 2016. Quote, 2016 is the Flight 93 election. Charge the cockpit or you die. You may die anyway. You or the leader or your party may make it into the cockpit and not know how to fly or land the plane. There are no guarantees. Except one, if you don't try, death is certain. To compound the metaphor, a Hillary Clinton presidency is Russian roulette with a semi-auto. With Trump, at least you spin the cylinder and take your chances. Yep. Like Anton, we spun the cylinder, we take our chances. What do we get?
Well, first, let's look at some of the things. Remember that is both a negative and a positive case. Mm-hmm. So let's look at some of the things we didn't get. Mm-hmm. I am writing right now. So Roger Kimball, who's the editor of the New Criterion and also of Encounter Books, wants to republish the Flight 93 election. Mm-hmm. And then I was massively criticized for it. And a week after it came out, I wrote something called The Restatement on Flight 93, where I just said, these are the five common criticisms. I will summarize them all and answer them. So Roger wants to republish both of those and something new, which I have in front of me because I'm still working on it. I'm almost finished, called The Pre-Statement on Flight 93, which says, basically, look, I made a negative case in the Flight 93 election. And what everybody, the most common criticism from friend and foe alike was to say, okay, your negative case is compelling, you know, whether I agree with it or not, it's compelling. But there's no positive vision underlying it. To which I say, yes, there is. I'm going to tell you what the positive vision was, what I thought was threatened, right? Which is a proper account of America, of the American founding, the American regime, what political justice requires and all of that, and what it's threatened from. So one of the ways I culminate this new article is saying that given what I've seen from the behavior of the left in the last 2 years, I feel absolutely vindicated by my prediction that had they gained power, things would be much worse than had they not gained power. They're actually quite powerful even when they're out of government, as we've seen from what social media companies are doing and so on and so forth. So then the positive case, I would say, what did we get? Well, look, we've got more rational immigration policy. I'd like the wall to have been built by now, but at least, you know, we have a president who believes in it and is trying to get it. We're getting, and I know this will not be popular among a lot of the Hoover audience, who I'm sure are free traders. I know my old friend Tim Kaine is a good free trader. But, you know, the free trade as it was practiced was not working out for America. Certainly not working out for giant swaths of American communities and states and industries. So we have a president that's willing to take on predatory trade practices in ways that other presidents have only talked about. We have a president that's recalibrating American foreign policy, I think, in healthy directions. So, you know, we got what the Flight 93 election and my blog called The Journal of American Greatness, or my blog jointly with others, always said that the case for Trump is sort of threefold. Secure borders, economic nationalism, and an interests-based or America-first foreign policy. To one degree or another, we're getting those things.
Right. So, well, you're in the Trump White House, Mike. I watched with great interest when the media would write about you. And they'd always try to explain, who is this man standing in the background? And they would go down all these different avenues. They would go through your writings. They would talk about your interest in cuisine. They would talk about your interest in Machiavelli, your interest in Tom Wolfe. What's it like to go from a rather anonymous existence, which is speech writing, to now being the object of interest?
Well, I'm not the object of that much interest. I mean, I can still walk down the street or go through an airport and be recognized by absolutely no one.
No, but I've seen articles that would call you Times the most influential man in the Trump White House, for example.
But that was not, I mean, that wasn't true. I wasn't the most influential.
It sounds like a beer ad.
Yeah, I mean, so, look, there's some interest in me, I would say, from within conservative intellectual world, right? Which is why I'm here. You know, the Hoover Institution is a conservative think tank. There are other conservative think tanks. There's been some interest in me from AEI. No, not everyone. I'm probably, I would say, quite unpopular overall at AEI, but Steve Hayward is a friend in it and also went to the Claremont Graduate School, and I've known him for a long time, so he had me there once. There's that level of interest. It's not that much. It's not overwhelming. I still feel fairly obscure. I don't know that I even go on TV sometimes. I've done Fox now and CNN combined maybe 24 times. Mm-hmm. But there's so much cable and there's so many people on TV and Washington's so filled with them that, like, I'm not even D-list probably in terms of Washington celebrity. Certainly not C, B, or A.
Okay, I'd like you to explain Donald Trump to me through three lenses. The Michael Anton lens, the Machiavelli lens, and then the Tom Wolfe lens. Yeah. So let's start back moving forward. Tom Wolfe. So briefly explain your friendship with Tom Wolfe, how that came about, and your fascination with the man.
Well, I met him I met him for the first time. He would attend Manhattan Institute events, and I worked for 1 year for the Manhattan Institute. I actually saw him at the very first Manhattan Institute event I ever went to when I was 23 years old.
Easy to recognize.
And yeah, he had the white suit. He was sitting at the head table next to the police commissioner. And I even had an he had already I had already written him a letter, and he had written back to me a nice letter. So I had my opportunity to go and shake his hand and tell him how wonderful I thought it was that he wrote me a letter, and I didn't do it. I chickened out. So I met him years later, you know, when I was much older. I would talk to him at Manhattan Institute events. He was always extremely friendly. I interviewed him twice for magazine articles that I wrote at length. He spent hours and hours with me at these interviews, and you know, then see him more and more in Manhattan Institute events. I did an on-stage event with him at the Manhattan Institute in, I want to say, 2014, mm-hmm. where it was just myself and Mr. Wolf. I asked him questions. He answered the questions. The audience was probably 200 or 300 people. And then I gave a small dinner talk once in 2016 that he attended, and he said he came just to hear me. I was blown away by that. So, you know, I got to know him a little toward the end of his life. It's not like we saw a great deal of each other, but we also emailed. He had an email account, and I went back and forth on emails with him. You know, I tried not to bother him too much, but you know, once a month or so, we would exchange letters.
So, what would Tom Wolf have made of Donald Trump?
Well, hard to say. Wolf told the world that he voted for George W. Bush in 2004, mm-hmm. and you know, I wouldn't say he suffered for it, but he was criticized for it, and he felt that it had been a mistake. That a cultural observer like himself should just keep his political opinions private.
Right.
He did say once that coming out in New York and admitting that you had voted for Bush was like being at a dinner party on the Upper East Side and saying, by the way, I forgot to mention I'm a child molester. I know he had a kind of, I don't want to say libertarian streak, but he definitely had a foreign policy realist streak in it. There was something in him that really liked Ron and Rand Paul for, you know, I don't know about the libertarian economics,
right.
but I did very much get the sense that he liked their foreign policy views, a much more radically restricted scope of American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. He publicly questioned the wisdom of the Iraq War very early. He basically said, I understand why we had to go into Afghanistan and deal with the Taliban. I'm mystified as to why we're going into Iraq. So that caused some of his affinity with the Pauls. I think he would have liked Trump's foreign policy in that sense, although Trump doesn't go as far the direction as the, you know, the Rand and Ron Paul mm-hmm. Would want him to go. The times that I saw him in 2016 and we talked about Trump, he didn't give me any indication either way. You know, he gave no evaluation of Trump as a policy, but he seemed to find amusing all of the over-the-top attacks on Trump, which led me to believe something inside of him was kind of sympathetic.
Okay, now your friend Machiavelli.
Machiavelli. What would Nick make of Trump? Well, first of all, I think Nick would like the fact that, you know, Trump was not just a gracious loser. I think Nick would sort of hold in contempt that type of Republican who comes along and says, I'm going to play by every rule that the other side sets for me, and it guarantees that I'm going down, and I'm going down with my dignity. And
right.
Nick would say, yeah, that and $2, you know, it won't even get you a cup of coffee. You got to play a little hardball if you're going to get anywhere. I think he would recognize the current political situation in America as a crisis situation that, you know, what we've been doing for 30 years, we can't keep doing forever and expect good results, that change had to come. Fundamentally what Machiavelli is a breaker of norms and a breaker of taboos. He sort of, in the realm of thought, finds himself in a time where thought is constrained by certain boundaries, and the job of his book is to break those boundaries and smash through. I can make an argument that he would have appreciated Trump just on that basis alone, if not on any other basis.
Now the Michael Anton view. I saw you on C-SPAN recently talking about Trump, and you raised an interesting point. You were talking about whether or not Donald Trump is a populist, and you raised an interesting question, Mike. You said, has anyone ever called a populist a positive thing?
Yeah.
Populist is always a negative thing.
It's always a slur, right?
A slur.
It's always a slur. And so my point was just, you know, populare is the root of populism, which means the people, but populare, that's bad. Well, democracy, which is always held to be good, the root of that is the demos, which also means the people, but in Greek, or a portion of the people, the masses. But one is good and the other is bad. I never figured out a way to square that circle. You know, the famous populists in American history, William Jennings Bryan. You know, in other words, populist is typically equated with demagoguery. It means you're appealing to the people's basest instincts and not any of their noble instincts. But I think it can also mean that you're appealing to some righteous anger and some legitimate dissatisfaction that has not been allayed or addressed in any way. So I just had to review for the CRB a bunch of books, almost all of them saying, you know, Trump is this dangerous demagogue who's going to be a tyrant and take over the world. And what I found was remarkable about these books is, really with one exception, none of them says that these popular concerns over immigration, trade, and foreign policy have any basis, any foundation. It's basically, we have a communications problem. You know, I've been in politics. We've been through this, right, where some politician, where everything is going badly, can't see it, won't admit it, and just says, well, we have a communications problem. We just need to explain ourselves better. Like, well, no, actually, maybe people are mad at you because you're screwing up.
Right? No, it's a movie, Wag the Dog, where Aunt Hetch is running around as a communications person forever screaming, I need talking points. Can't go out there without talking points. So, yeah, right, so it's a communications thing. But you look at Donald Trump, Mike, and though he's a Republican, but he's just kind of passing through the Republican Party. He's been a Democrat before, yeah. And now he's a Republican. He's a conservative, but... You know, he's probably to the left on a lot of social issues. You really push him on, you know, foreign policy. You know, he's, you know, around a map on different things. So where do we put this guy on the political scale?
I think probably he's transforming the Republican Party. And I hope in good ways. I think in good ways, right? He's waking up there's a great article by two guys who I'm 99% sure, well, I know one of them was anti-Trump. I'm pretty sure the other one was. They wrote it first for the Weekly Standard, and then they wrote a book about it. This is Ross Douthat of the New York Times and Rehan Salam, who's, I don't know where he works now, but I used to see him. He'd come to Manhattan Institute events, too. So they wrote an article for the Weekly Standard that basically says, you know, it's amazing the Republican Party gets any votes at all because it never does anything for the people who vote for it.
Right.
And then they wrote a whole book based on this thesis. And all of their policy prescriptions, or almost all of them that I can recall, were really sound. Like, they were good. They were things that the Republican Party, if it had any sense, would be doing. Trump comes along and he basically picks up a lot of that platform. We need to do things for working and lower middle class, Rust Belt voters, not just geographically concentrated, although that's where they are concentrated, but working and lower middle class voters around the country. And, you know, what I found amazing is that there were a number of conservative intellectuals who had made this case before. Trump comes along and they can't find it. They can't see past themselves to support him. There were a number of conservative intellectuals who had pretty bravely taken on the elite immigration consensus, and some of them, but by no means all of them, they couldn't find, you know, some of them said, I can't support this guy. He's the first presidential candidate to really take it seriously in forever. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I, you know, we remember 1994, right? Pete Wilson won on Prop 187, which was immediately enjoined by the courts and never enforced. He's been demonized for it forever after, right? How many times have we had to have the same argument? Well, the only reason California tipped left is because of Pete Wilson.
Right.
It's crazy. I think we've, you know, you and I and others have written the case over and over again that that's not true. Wilson was right. Yeah, I think Wilson has been completely vindicated by events. Whether that'll ever, he'll ever get credit for that in the popular mind or in the intellectual mind, I don't know. I hope so. I'll do my best.
Good to hear. I'm always fascinated by the thought, Mike, of Donald Trump did a mic drop. If he just came out at some point next year and said, I'm not running for re-election, which... It's not the most far-fetched thing. Donald Trump likes to shock us at all times. He could shock us and decide he's not running for a second term and say that, look, I've set out to do what I want to do. Look at the economy. Look at foreign policy. I've reset things. What happens to the Republican field in 2020 if Donald Trump does not run? It seems to me, Mike, you have a repeat of 2016 where you're going to have 10 to 12 to 15 people all claiming to be the voice of the Republican Party.
You probably will have a very large field of candidates, but I think the ground and issues in which they will be fought will have been shifted forever. It's not going to be Trump versus 16 conventional Republicans trying to rerun the Reagan platform or the W. Bush compassionate conservative platform of 2000. That's not going to happen again.
Right.
I don't think you're not going to see. I mean, you might see a John Kasich or some type like that. You know, there's always in every Republican primary, there's always some Republican who just comes to run against the Republican Party. In 2016, it was Kasich. In the past, it's been Huntsman. So somebody will do that and get nowhere. What you're not going to see is an entire rest of the field that's trying to run on a platform that's over and past. Trump will have heirs in that field, whoever they are. You know, I would assume that somebody like Tom Cotton would be one of them, and he will run on a fairly explicitly Trumpian type of platform. And we will see. I mean, to some extent, to a very large extent, if this transformation of the Republican Party is going to work, it has to be decoupled from Trump. It can't just be, tied to his personality forever, because he won't be around forever. You know, so a great example is, we were talking about Giuliani earlier. Myron Magnet, the longtime editor of City Journal, used to say that the only criticism he had of Rudy is that he didn't groom a successor. So that the danger was that all of the success at in public safety and welfare reform and other than that was linked to him personally. And then when he's gone, the New York City just goes back to the way it was. It just gets taken over by the same people and they do everything. Now, it kind of is
right
with de Blasio. But Rudy being followed by 12 years of Michael Bloomberg, which was a kind of a happenstance that Rudy didn't plan for, turned out to be an incredibly good thing, A, for Rudy's legacy, but B, for the city. Because then you had 20 years of consecutive government of those policies. Not that Bloomberg didn't change some things, but he kept the core of those policies being enforced, and they put down roots. So something like that has to happen to the Republican Party, and it has to happen for Trump. He either needs to find heirs, or heirs need to find him. Otherwise, the things that he's trying to do are going to be a lot more tenuous and threatened.
Let's step back to the Flight 93 election for a moment, Mike, and I want to read to you some words written by Brett Stevens in May of 2017. Quote, "To reread the Flight 93 election today is to understand what has gone wrong, not only with the Trump presidency, but also with so much of the conservative movement writ large. In a word, it's become unhinged."
Yes, I would say Brett Stevens is one of the most unhinged commentators I can think of. I mean, he wrote a column in the New York Times only a couple of months ago, literally saying, okay, yes, I am for open borders. Basically, if you're not a terrorist or a criminal, then everyone alive in the world who we can't prove is a terrorist or a criminal should be welcome to move to the United States of America. That is a fanatical, extreme position that I think is shared by almost no one in the Republican Party, and probably not even shared by some, plurality of the Democratic Party, if not a majority of the Democratic Party. But it's the job of an intellectual or a commentator is to think through arguments and realize absurdities when they see them, not to state absurdities and be incapable of thinking through all of their logical deficiencies. So in case people are curious, I wrote a fairly extensive takedown of Stevens' argument for the website American Greatness. It comes to something like 4,000 words. He made 6 claims. I think I pretty convincingly rebutted all of them. But to be called unhinged by a guy like that, one doesn't really know what to say. It's like being called a bad hitter by Manny Mendoza.
But the word unhinged is people Stevens write these columns, is it so much what you wrote that they have a problem with, or is it just Donald Trump? And if it's Donald Trump, what is it about Trump that unhinges them?
It's both. It's partly what I wrote. Look, the conservative intellectual movement didn't know how to deal with and still doesn't know how to deal with Donald Trump. And we've seen, to a certain extent, a conservative intellectual movement come apart. You know, a lot of neocons, which, you'd have to say, if Stevens is a conservative, and I would say that he's not, but if he is, he's a neocon. Well, a lot of neocons are going home. They're essentially saying, I give up on this movement.
Right.
Some have formally left the Republican Party. Some have not. But certainly, there are fault lines within the movement that I don't think are going to be resolved. I think, the conservative movement is the Reagan coalition of the foreign policy hawks, the religious conservatives, social conservatives, and the economic libertarians is not coming back together again the way it was.
Okay, I want to read one more passage, one more article you wrote. It'll be a final topic for the day. You wrote in the Claremont Review of Books, quote, "Will the real authoritarian police stand up?" And here's your passage, quote, "Sigmund Freud is not a writer I would have picked up had he not been assigned, but I'm glad he was. The older I get and the more of the left I see, the more useful becomes Freud's concept of projection, an unconscious defense mechanism that protects the ego from guilt or anxiety. It has amazing explanatory power and can help one make sense of a trove of recent books by left-wing writers and one disgruntled former conservative that blamed Donald Trump for quote-unquote authoritarianism in American politics."
Yeah, so the thesis of that piece, that's the book, the review that I mentioned earlier of 6 books. It's the same piece.
Right.
So one of the things that I learned from my days in Claremont, and in particular John Marini, one of the best of the Claremont-trained scholars, is this threat to liberty from what's called the administrative state that begins in the Progressive Era, the capital P Progressive Era in the late 19th century. It's the building of this giant apparatus. So the executive, the Constitution is 3 branches of government. The executive branch is supposed to implement policy and carry it out. So the president needs foot soldiers. That's always been true. But under the guise of the executive branch, we've built what's really a fourth branch called the administrative state, which is a sort of bureaucratic rule that takes political decisions out of the hands of the American people. Now, this is explicitly explained by the progressives at the time, that they say politics is now more of a science than a matter of, you know, public disagreement. And as science, there are simply correct and incorrect answers, and politics can become the administration of things. And so you have experts determine the answers, and then you have sort of functionaries or bureaucrats just carry its stuff out, and the people need not ever really be troubled about that. That's the real threat to democracy for the last 125 years. That is what has made this country less democratic over the last 125 years. And I found it ironic and kind of annoying that all of the, you know, a bunch of liberal scholars with very impeccable Ivy League and Oxbridge credentials come along, and they all wag their finger in heavily footnoted pseudoscientific tome saying Donald Trump is an authoritarian threat to democracy, when these very same people and all of the authors and arguments that they rely on have been building the administrative state and throttling democracy for 100 years. So I thought, you know, you guys really shouldn't be allowed to get away with that.
Well, this to me is the interesting dichotomy. You have critics who would claim that Donald Trump is Rigoletto and critics who claim that Donald Trump is Mussolini. That he is either he's either a clown or he is a dictator, one of the other.
Well, remember too that you even have that problem or issue within the conservative movement.
Right.
When National Review did their Never Trump or Against Trump, whatever it was, symposium in December of 2015, the key arguments made, and they had like 30 people, but the most common argument was this guy's not a real conservative. You know, we need you know, somebody like Rubio or Cruz much more checks the box of what conservatism is since the Reagan Revolution. And within 6 months, conservatives, or a lot of them, are saying, this guy is a dangerous right-wing threat to the republic. Hey, do you remember 6 months ago when you said that his problem with him was that he was insufficiently conservative? So he can be both insufficiently conservative and a right-wing authoritarian fascist? I don't know how that circle gets squared. The only common thread is, we just don't like Trump.
Mike Anton, if you were to redo the 2020, revise the Flight 93 election article for the 2020 election, who is the equivalent of Hillary in this new scenario?
The one that scares me the most is Kamala Harris. And the reason for that is, you know, having grown up in Northern California and having some familiarity with the California Democratic Party, and also...
You went to Berkeley.
And I've gone to Berkeley, and so I know something about Bay Area left-wing politicians, intellectuals, and activists. And they are the most zealous and frightening of any in the country, I think. Mm-hmm. And they are pretty relentless and angry. As bad as a Hillary Clinton presidency would be, as bad as an Elizabeth Warren presidency would be, there might even be one or two silver linings in an Elizabeth Warren presidency that I can, you know, extrapolate on later. And there are some actual overlap. I mean, the Venn diagram between Bernie Sanders' concerns and Donald Trump's concerns, they're not completely separate. There is some commonality there. And there were some Bernie people, I don't think it was a huge thing, but there were some Bernie people in the Democratic primaries who came over and voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. Because Hillary was just so obviously a representative of the kind of bipartisan ruling class consensus that the Bernie people were rejecting. And
right.
Trump was a rejecter of that consensus too. I can't find any silver lining to a Kamala Harris. Doomsday scenario that I painted in one of the paragraphs of the Flight 93 election, I think she would read that paragraph, which I meant as be afraid, be very afraid. She would read the same paragraph and go, of course that's what we're trying to do, and you have it coming.
Okay, final question. So you are now a resident of Washington, D.C. Congratulations, you're a swamp creature.
Yeah, Northern Virginia. And actually, I live outside the Beltway, so I'm not sure if that makes me a swamp creature or not.
Okay, extended swamp creature.
Yeah.
How long do you want to live here? Do you worry about getting kind of sucked into the culture the longer you stay here?
I doubt it. I'm not. Maybe I should worry about it, but I'm not worried about it, partly because I'm not angling for any administration jobs. Mm-hmm. I'm not angling for the normal, you know, status stuff that matters in Washington. I'm kind of here to do, after a 20-year detour or 25-year detour, what I was initially trained to do, which is teach political philosophy. So it's almost like my career is finally getting back on track after a decade and a half of wandering in the desert.
Mike Anton, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. And for this podcast, Michael Anton, his views on Donald Trump. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Mike Anton, where do people find you online?
Well, I'm not on Twitter. I never will be, and I always ask people in public, if you ever see me on Twitter, come to my house, find me, and just kill me. You'll know that I've gone crazy. So I just can't take Twitter. I publish frequently in the Claremont Review of Books. I publish sometimes. I mean, I'm kind of everywhere. I publish sometimes in the American Greatness website. I've published a couple of things in the Washington Post. I'm doing something now again for Roger Kimball, which will be a print book. I don't know what his online plans for it. So I guess I don't really yet have an online home. Hillsdale doesn't have a blog or anything like that. But I'm fundamentally kind of a long format guy. I find the hard stuff short to write. So anywhere where they're publishing 5,000 to 10,000 word pretentious essays, you might find me.
And if somebody's not familiar with the works of Tom Wolfe, what should they start with?
I always thought a great gateway to Wolfe is Radical Chic. It's short. It's absolutely hilarious. It kind of has all his themes. That's happenstance because it's the first Wolfe book that I read, so maybe I'm recommending it for that reason. But you can read it in very quickly. You know, doesn't even take a whole day to get through it, and you will crack a rib laughing. It is so incredibly funny.
Okay, Mike Anton, great talking to you.
Thanks.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts and ideas from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org.